Welcome to the Michael Rivero What Really Happened radio program.
And aloha, America. Welcome to the show. It's Saturday, our end of the week. Look back at all the news here. The phone lines are open. Chat room is running. Webcam is up and running. We're all systems are go, and we're just going to have a really good time for all you free-range humans who are ready to step off the line, out of the box, and over the barbed wire. Phone number is 800-259-9231, 800-259-9231. Jeff is in the control room today, twiddling the dials, keeping us out of trouble, one hand hovering over the phone, the other hovering over the five-second delay, so we're ready to rock here. Now, we are basically in a holding pattern here. We're expecting Cindy Sheehan to be calling in somewhere around the bottom of the hour, and as soon as she comes online, we're gonna go right to her. She and her fellow protesters are out there on the water, on the ocean, outside Martha's Vineyard. They're sailing around, holding up their banners, and basically trying to convey their message of opposition to the continuation of the wars to President Barack Obama and his family. And it is rather interesting to see the dichotomy in the way the corporate media has been treating her and her situation. Back when Bush was in the White House, the media was just, they couldn't get enough of her. They absolutely loved her. She was the darling. And now that Obama is in the White House, all of a sudden the media doesn't want to have anything to do with her. Of course, you know, their loss is our gain. We're going to have her on the show again. And we'll see her in just a little bit. Now, turning to the news here, and starting with the economy as we always tend to do, last night, at end of business day, the FDIC closed 3 banks and 1 credit union. This brings the total number of bank failures this year to 84. Now, remember, the FDIC second quarter report on the health of the banks has put more than 400 additional banks at risk of failure in the immediate future. So the situation is still deteriorating. We have not hit bottom. It's not turning around. They closed banks in Maryland, Minnesota, and California. And looking at the chart of bank failures, I mean, California is California is especially hard hit. I'm sorry, I sounded distracted. I'm getting word from the control room. We've got some live streaming features not working. Oh, probably that's the Windows. Tell them to switch to a different player. There's been a problem with the Windows. Okay, all right, we're done with that. Here, back to the show. Now, we talked about earlier in the week how the Federal Reserve had appealed a decision on a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit requiring them to disclose who got all these emergency loans over over the last year. And the Federal Reserve has been handing out trillions and trillions of dollars. We don't know to whom. We don't know what collateral was pledged. We, the American people, have a right to know this, because if the people who got those loans default, and if there is inadequate collateral to cover those losses, we, the American people, are the final guarantor of those loans. Whether we like it or not, it was done without our permission. So we're on the hook, ultimately, for this money if it doesn't come back from who it was loaned to. And the Federal Reserve has taken the position it's not our business to know. And their position is that if word gets out that these banks needed the help, that customers might decide to leave and go elsewhere. Well, we're the customers. It's our money the banks are working with. We do have a right to know if these banks are not being well managed, if they've made some very foolish decisions. We have a right as consumers to know that. So the courts agreed, and now the Federal Reserve has appealed that decision, and they have succeeded in getting a federal judge order, a stay of execution on the preceding order, so that they don't have to release this information yet while the process goes on through appeal. So they're just going to keep the lid on this forever and ever and ever and ever. And it's just going to go right up to the Supreme Court. And I'm hoping the Supreme Court will take the position that we, the American people, since our taxes ultimately pay all the bills to the Federal Reserve, that we, the American people, have a right to know where that money is going. We have a fundamental right to know if the banks that we are doing business with are in trouble. We have a right to know that. We have a right of full disclosure. We have to have that. Now, getting back into the economy, we mentioned this briefly yesterday, but I want to get into it in a little more depth. Americans are having to triage what little money they have. They're having to choose between mortgage, food, taxes, medical bills. And unfortunately, utilities are starting to be turned off. We are seeing over in Illinois, they're reporting there is literally a major increase in the number of households they've had to pull the plug on because the utility bills are 60 and in some cases 90 days delinquent. Now, this is going to be a problem because we're going into what is looks to be a very rough winter, despite the prognostications of St. Al of the Gore. The world is actually getting colder. This is going to be a rough, rough winter. We have to make sure that homes are getting whatever energy they need to keep them heated so that people are not freezing to death. And there's a practical side to this. If the public utilities or private utilities are pulling the plugs or shutting off the gas to these homes, they're going to start, you know, doing fires to keep themselves warm. And if they've got a fireplace, that's all well and good. But fireplaces are now something that are not all that common in modern buildings. And so people are going to set up grills or whatever. There's going to be carbon monoxide poisonings. And worse, we're going to see buildings catch on fire from this kind of stuff. And there's going to be a lot of property damage and damage to life and limb. So at this point, while there is still time to do it and implement it, you know, and given the state of the economy, we need to guarantee that the utilities are not allowed to shut off power, whether it's electricity or gas, to homes that are in the coldest parts of our country going into this next winter. As just a sheer matter of humanitarian assistance and keeping people alive through a very difficult winter. It's got to be done. Now, we've been talking, of course, about Alan Stanford's case. We've been talking about all these frauds. You know, what's that saying? When the tide goes out, you find out who's swimming around naked. And the tide has gone out, and we're seeing more and more people, like Bernie Madoff with the loot, and Alan Stanford and a bunch of others, who have been exposed as building their wealth and that of their clients using fraud and pyramid schemes and various other games. And we're starting to see some of the minor players in these little Ponzi schemes. They're starting to plead guilty and plea bargain, and they're starting to make deals and name names. So we're getting a confirmation from the Stanford Group's financial officer, the chief financial officer, basically saying, yeah, it was a fraud. It was a crook in charge of the whole situation. And here's the situation. In a country that has lost so much of its manufacturing, in a country whose government has literally sent high-paying jobs to other countries and allowed outsourcing, gave tax credits to corporations that encouraged offshoring of jobs, does it make sense that certain Wall Street firms are still raking in the money like AIG, that only 6 months ago was like hanging by a thread and saved by taxpayer dollars, and now they're reporting huge profitability? It just doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense unless something is going wrong on here behind the scenes that we don't know about. And, of course, the government that is supposed to be keeping an eye on this stuff has totally abrogated that responsibility. We saw that with Bernie Madoff. Somebody at the SEC told an investigator, do not investigate Bernie. Henry Mackeros went in there with all the evidence on a silver platter that Bernie Madoff was doing something crooked, and it was ignored. So federal government is, they're part of the problem. They're part of the problem over there. Now, speaking of federal government, a little scandal brewing about Representative Charles Rangel. Apparently, he's one of these politicians who is so rich they absolutely cannot remember all of their housing and all of their wealth, because apparently on his financial disclosure forms between 2002 and 2006, he left a few things off, including an entire house and some $3 million in various business transactions. And we don't know if perhaps he was trying to evade taxes, or he was trying to avail himself of some additional funds and he had to stay below a threshold. We don't know. But he wasn't being honest, and that's the important part. We're going to take a break. We'll be back after these words from our sponsors, 800-259-9231, and we will be right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome to What Really Happened Radio. Visit us online at whatreallyhappened.com. And now, set your eyes on the future, and let's consider what really happened.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to our show here. We're talking about the economy. And just to get a little bit local out here in Hawaii, we have been reporting, as you know, that tax revenues at all levels of government are really plunging. The numbers that we have is federal tax revenues are off 44% from last year. Various state revenues have dropped anywhere between 17 and 24%. Now we're hearing that the tax revenues picture here in Hawaii is actually worse than previously reported. We're in the middle of this really big brouhaha between our governor, Linda Lingle, and the union for government employees, and they're in this fight over whether they're going to have to accept layoffs because of the budget cuts, or if they're willing to go along with the program of furloughs, where they're working a little bit less than full time in order to save some funding. And the difficulty here is because of the union contracts, that very often jobs are preserved for contractual reasons that are perhaps less essential to the society than some others. We're seeing some very drastic cuts in the educational system, and that's absolutely the last place we should have it, because, you know, the ability for us to pull out of this economic mess rests with training our population to be able to compete in a modern technological global marketplace. And right now that is being let go. All of a sudden, this local charity that my wife and I work for, we're all of a sudden getting busy again. We round up used computers from businesses and stuff, and we refurbish them, and we place them in schools and nonprofit organizations. And for a while, you know, during the economic boom times here, during the froth up when everybody had money and credit to play with, we couldn't find places for these machines to go to. And that's a problem, because we don't want them to go into landfills. Now all of a sudden it's getting busy, and people are calling saying, we need a machine. We're desperate. So we'll see what's going on over there. But it is getting, pretty bad out here. And they're saying basically they're trying to reassure us there's going to be a sharp rebound after next year. They're saying we're going to be in a slump till summer of next year, and then there's going to be a rebound. I don't know what they're basing that on. I don't know what they're basing that on, because our tourism is down, and until the TSA stops abusing people at the airports, and they're going to keep on doing it. The guy they down on Maui, they got him looting jewelry out of travelers' luggage, and he went to jail for 90 days. That's not a deterrent, not for some of the jewelry that he probably got. So, meanwhile, we've got a huge, huge development down on Maui, the McKenna Resort. They were going to refurbish that and get that going. That financing fell through, so that's just going to sit there. And especially here in Hawaii. Oh, that was on the Big Island. I stand corrected. The problem with here in Hawaii is if you have a construction project and you are forced to stop partway through, and the existing construction is not protected against this climate, it very, very quickly deteriorates to the point where it has to be torn down and rebuilt from scratch. We've seen that a couple of places here in Honolulu, where somebody will start a big new project and the financing goes away. And it just sits there open to the elements, to the rain and the sea, the salt air. And after about 6 months, it's basically at the point it has to all be torn down before any new work can be done. So it's a rough climate here. Now, let's see. Final word on the economy, and then we're going to move on to some international news here. It is being reported that profits for farmers, for U.S. farmers, are plunging 38% from last year because the recession is eroding demand for crops, livestock, and dairy products. A big part of it is that people are being a little bit more cautious about food wastage. This, I think, is actually a good thing, because up until the economy went south, it was estimated that almost half of the food produced in this country winds up being thrown away at different points along the supply chain, into the homes and everything. The stuff's just being thrown away. It's a terrible, terrible waste. And especially when you look at how much hunger and starvation there is around the world, there shouldn't be any wastage at all. Certainly not to that level. So people are beginning to be a little bit more careful about not being so wasteful with food, and that's a good thing. And maybe there'll be a little bit left over where we can start taking care of some of the people who've fallen out the bottom of our social structure, and they're trying to climb back up and in. And and get these people fed. I know there are operations. We were trying to start one here in Honolulu, but there are operations in major cities called food rescue units. And what they do is they go around to restaurants and hotels and places like that, and they simply collect uneaten prepared food and immediately drive out to where the homeless people are and say, here, you can have this. And I think it's a good idea. I think it's much better. I know there's an insurance risk, and the lawyers love to swarm all over it and say, well, there's a liability issue here, and you've got to do this, and you've got to do that. But there are some courageous people who are making this happen anyway, and they're going out there, and it's just every little thing you can do right now. Because, folks, it comes down to this. The government's not going to take care of you. We, the American people, have to take care of ourselves. And the more we take care of ourselves, the less we need a government. We can actually run our own country and take care of our own communities ourselves. We don't need the government to come take our tax money, spread it around a bunch of cronies, and then send a few pennies back and say, see, we're taking care of the social necessities. Because clearly, at this time, it's not working. Anyway, so I guess my message there on my little soapbox moment here on this Saturday is, get involved with your local community. I know there's something, you're looking out your doors and your windows, you see something that needs to be worked on, and you need to get involved, because the more you get involved in your local community, the more you can tell the federal government to say, stay out, we've got it covered, go away, leave us alone. And I think that's kind of the tendency that we're seeing right now. All right, moving into Afghanistan, looking at the clock here, we're hoping Cindy Sheehan will be calling in the next few minutes here. But moving to Afghanistan, as you know, there's this election going on, and Hamid Karzai is claiming victory and claiming his lead is widening, despite very obvious indications of vote fraud, not the least of which is that a couple of dozen ballot boxes from districts that heavily favored his opponent somehow got dropped out of a U.S. military Chinook helicopter on their way to the counting center. It doesn't get more obvious than that. And what's amazing is the same corporate media outlets that were screaming that Ahmadinejad's election victory in Iran just had to be the result of fraud are remaining absolutely silent about the far more obvious signs of election rigging going on in Afghanistan. The reason is very simple. The U.S. government doesn't like Ahmadinejad, therefore his election victory must be a fraud. The U.S. government loves Hamid Karzai, His Excellency from UNOCAL, and therefore his election must be honest, no matter how obvious to the contrary. And what's interesting is, and I think this is the most telling sign of all, at a time when Hamid Karzai is set to declare himself the continuing leader of Afghanistan, the U.S. is getting ready to send more troops to Afghanistan to protect him from the people who supposedly just overwhelmingly voted him back into power. And they're talking some 20,000 new troops to go into Afghanistan. And meanwhile, NATO is basically admitting that the Taliban is growing in the northern part of Afghanistan. And that's getting into that mountainous territory that is so difficult to operate in. And it looks like we're not winning this one. But I guess as long as the gas pipeline flows and the opium poppies grow, that things are going to just be considered perfectly peachy and worth sacrificing American lives for. We're going to take a commercial break here. When we be back, hopefully we'll be talking to Cindy Sheehan. Otherwise, we'll be talking about other stuff. So stay tuned, and we'll be right back.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio? Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
We will not go down in the night without a fight. You can burn up our mosques and our homes and our schools, but our spirit will never die. We will not go down.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show. We have been given a heads up that Cindy Sheehan will be calling into the show shortly. Could be any minute. We're just going to keep talking until she shows up here. And because she's calling in, I want to take a moment here to talk about these wars. I want to talk about these wars. We know the wars were created out of thin air. We know that the war in Iraq was based on a claim that Saddam had banned weapons of mass destruction and was defying the United Nations. We know that was a complete lie. We were sold the war on the claim that Saddam Hussein was aiding al-Qaeda. We now know that that entire claim rested on a single confession coerced under torture. We know we were sold this war on the idea that Iraq was somehow connected to 9/11. We have both Dick Cheney and George Bush on videotape admitting that was not true. There is no reason for this war to exist, let alone be perpetuated and continued at great cost to our young people's lives and health. There's no reason for, and here's the bottom line. This war is unwinnable. This war is unwinnable in the political sense, in the public sense, because all of the public reasons given for this war cannot be achieved, because they were all lies. We cannot succeed in disarming Iraq because it never had the nuclear weapons. We cannot punish Iraq for 9/11 because they had nothing to do with it. And we cannot prevent Iraq from supporting al-Qaeda because they were never doing it in the first place. This is a no-win situation. Whatever the real objectives are for this war, and most people seem to feel it is simply smashing up Iraq because Israel said to do it. But the public justifications for the war in Iraq are completely bogus, and therefore, in the eyes of history, in the eyes of the world, this war cannot be won. We cannot achieve the publicly stated goals for this war. Now, as far as Afghanistan is concerned, we know that all the way back in the mid-1990s, a group of oil company executives, including Hamid Karzai, went before Congress and said, we're trying to get oil and gas from the Caspian Sea down to a shipping terminal in the Indian Ocean, and the only stickler is Afghanistan that refuses to sell us the pipeline right of way at the price we want. Therefore, until there is a brand new government in Afghanistan, we are not going to be able to get our oil and gas at a price that we want to get it. Now, in the spring of 2001, March and April, the U.S. government was already informing other governments around the world of a plan to invade Afghanistan and forcibly change the government. In spring of 2001, we, the American people, were not told this. We were getting all Gary Condit all the time, and Chandra Levy, and where is she, and was there sex, and was there murder, and all this other distraction. But the plan by the United States government to invade Afghanistan was publicized at the BBC, Jane's Defense, numerous other international magazines and newspapers were reporting. U.S. will invade Afghanistan in October. So then, okay, we're going to go right to the phone. Cindy, joining us here is Cindy Sheehan. Aloha, welcome back to the show. I understand you're nowhere near as lonely as some people were predicting. Okay, I think we just lost the connection. We lost her. Okay, I'm sure she'll be calling right back in. As we said before, she's out on a boat, out on the ocean. She's using cell phones. The communications are a little bit dicey, but as soon as she comes back, we'll be putting her back on the air. But it's wonderful for her to call in here. Anyway, to get back to the situation with Afghanistan, in the spring of 2001, the U.S. government was telling other governments, we're going to invade Afghanistan in October. It was reported in the foreign press. It was not reported in the American press. And hang on a second. Do we have her call dropped? Okay. I love modern technology. Okay, he'll let me know. All right, so here's the situation. September 11th happens. The World Trade Towers come down. George Bush sits in a school reading about goats. The Secret Service lets him sit there, supposedly with an unknown number of airplanes crashing into buildings all over America, and Bush's presence at that school announced in the media 3 days ahead of time, and the Secret Service just lets him sit there with an airport only 4 miles away. There's a clue for you. And next thing you know, we've got to go after Osama bin Laden, and he's in Afghanistan, so we've got to invade Afghanistan. And the American people, shocked by the attack on the World Trade Towers, supports the war that the U.S. government has been planning for months in advance. It's a hoax. Somebody, I forget who, wrote in their diary, the modern-day version of Pearl Harbor had just happened, and was absolutely correct. Absolutely correct, because Pearl Harbor was another war-starting hoax. We have covered this from documents declassified in 1994. Roosevelt not only knew the Japanese were coming to attack Pearl Harbor, he had goaded them into it following an eight-step plan by Office of Naval Intelligence Lieutenant Commander Arthur H. McCollum. And living here on Oahu, I've been able to do a lot of local research and confirm this stuff, that in point of fact, the radio traffic from the fleet was being intercepted not only by government listening stations, even the Matson steamship, the SS Lurline, their radio operator was hearing the fleet approaching. And he gave his log to the U.S. Navy 3 days before the actual attack and said, there's a huge Japanese military force out there just to the northwest. What are you going to do about it? All wars based in deception, according to Sun Tzu. What that means is when a world leader decides he's going to attack another country, he's got to lie and trick his own people into going to that war. He's got to make them believe there is no other choice but to attack. Hitler did it in Gleiwitz, Germany. Sent his own people, disguised as Poles, to knock down the twin radio towers at the Gleiwitz radio station. Bush, aided by Israel apparently, did the same thing with the Twin Towers in New York. It's all to start. Cindy Sheehan is back in here going right to the phones. Aloha, Cindy. Welcome back to the show. What's on your mind? I understand that you're not quite as alone as some people feared you might be.
Can you hear me now?
I can hear you. What's going on out there?
Well, right now we're in the middle of a tropical storm, so...
Oh, man!
Yeah, so anyway, we were supposed to have a big peace vigil in the town square today, and it got rained out, but Obama has left to go to Senator Kennedy's funeral today anyway. But no, I'm not nearly as alone, you know, but there's a lot of anti-war sentiment out there for sure. We have a lot of solidarity, but it's not as strong as when George Bush was president, unfortunately, even though the policies continue, as a matter of fact, get worse.
Well, Cindy, I would have to disagree with you, and I think we have to count the weather factor in, because from where I sit at my radio show and my website, the anti-war sentiment is still just as strong. It's unfortunately, sadly, the corporate media is not backing you as much as they did, because now it's, you know, their own bias relative to the current presidency. But I know when we announced that you were going to be on our show today, we got a tremendous response from people.
No, I know the anti-war sentiment is still strong. I said that. People are, you know, they're either have a disconnect, because if they're anti-war Democrats, there's a disconnect thinking that their position and my position is the same as Obama's position, so they don't think that they have to be out protesting.
Mm-hmm.
Or some of the larger anti-war groups have sold out to the Democratic Party, and that they're not involved in any more large-scale protests against the policies of the administration. And it makes me think that some of the anti-war groups and their protests were partisan, and they were more anti-Bush than they were anti-war. But no, trust me, I know that there's a strong, strong anti-war sentiment out here in America. But like you said, the corporate media just is not following up on it.
Okay, well, Cindy, I know you're very busy, and I hear the phone connection dropping, and we got to go to break, but thank you very much for sharing time with us today, and you are so courageous. I can't tell you what a pleasure it's been to have you on the show today. Thank you very much. All right, that was Cindy Sheehan. We got to take a break. We'll be right back.
What this country is coming to, I sure would like to know. If they don't do something by and by, the rich will live and the poor will die. Doggone. The panic is on.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show here. And boy, talk about a frustrating experience. I mean, poor Cindy Sheehan, she's out there. They've been hit by a major storm. They got communication glitches. Obama's already left to go to Ted Kennedy's funeral. And that's got to be frustrating for somebody who has devoted so much of her life to opposing the war here. And, of course, it's frustrating for me because of the communication difficulties that her call came in butting right up against the commercial break. And those are unfortunately set in stone, actually in silicon. And we're not able to, like, punch a button and override those, unfortunately, which is very, very frustrating. But Cindy did have one valid point, and that is that a lot of Americans are still suckered into this idea of loyalty to their political party. And I remember back during the Bush administration where, everybody sort of got used to me just constantly bashing on the Clintons, you know, for Vince Foster and looting Social Security and Iran-Contra and all the people who were dying around them and everything. And then Bush came in, they figured, well, Rivera's just going to go away here. And I started right in on George Bush and said, what a disappointment this guy has been. And I pounded on him and just said, wait a minute, are you Republican or Democrat? And I said, well, hereditarily, traditionally, ancestrally, I'm a Republican. My grandfather used to get drunk with Richard Nixon all the time here. And I said, well, if you're a Republican, why are you opposed to Bush's policies? That's because I don't agree with the policies. It's got nothing to do with Republican or Democrat. Yeah, I believe in the core principles of the original conservative movement. If you want a designation, call me a paleoconservative. Limited government, fiscal responsibility, and otherwise, leave everybody alone. That's the basic philosophy I have about government and people. That government governs best, which governs least, is my personal philosophy. I'm definitely not liberal. I don't want government tinkering in every single aspect of my life. Go away. Leave me alone. You know, just a bunch of fleas leaping on your body, and they've all got political agenda papers with them. But I'm not the kind of Republican who is going to support and back a president who is wrong. And George Bush was wrong. Now, Cindy, unfortunately, is correct. A lot of the opposition to the war was being put forward by Democrats who saw it as an opportunity to bring down the Republicans. Well, actually, the Republicans were bringing themselves down, but the Democrats wanted to help. And now that it's a Democratic Congress and a Democratic White House, they're saying, oh, well, gee, yeah, they're continuing the war that I used to oppose, but now it's my party, and golly, I don't want to be a traitor to the party. And I'm sorry, but didn't the Nazis kind of say stuff like that, that even though Hitler's wars are wrong, I can't be a traitor to the party? I'm sorry, this is the 21st century. We have to grow past loyalty to the party. I mean, that's Soviet Union thinking. That's Nazi Germany thinking. That's fascist Italy thinking. Loyalty to the party. How about loyalty to all of the people of the country at the same time? What is best for them as a whole? Not just what's best for your party and your group. What's best for the American people? What's best for the people of the world? I oppose the war, and it's got nothing to do with partisanship. When it was a Republican president putting forward these wars based on lies, I was opposed. With a Democratic president perpetuating these wars based on lies, I'm opposed to that too, and so should you be. You should never, ever allow the party affiliations to be an interference toward doing what is morally right. Do not support a leader who is doing wrong things, whether it's torture or war or criminality, just because it happens to be your party. That is the lowest form of political sellout. What you're in essence is saying is it's okay to lie about countries and start wars. It's okay to torture and wrongfully imprison and lie, cheat, and steal, as long as it's my party that gets to do it. That doesn't reflect well on party members. When they sell out like that, we're supposed to be a moral people. We're supposed to be above allowing members of our party to commit and get away with war crimes. And so I did misunderstand Cindy. It sounded to me like she thought that people opposition to the war had flagged, and I don't see that from where I sit. But she's absolutely correct. A lot of the anti-war organizations that flourished during the Bush years were very clearly partisan. And now that it's their party in power, they're pulling back and saying, well, maybe I guess the war is kind of okay and torture is kind of okay because now it's our people doing it. I'm sorry. That was the mistake the German people made following the Nazi Party. That's the mistake the Russian people made following the Soviet Party. And it leads to disaster. Because instead of having a nation of moral people, you have a nation of people following the morality of the leaders. And very often, the leaders simply are not moral. In a very sick, twisted kind of historical sense, that's how they get to be the leaders, because they're willing to do things moral people are not. History has shown that the teller of black lies, little white lies rather, is going to defeat the totally honest man. The teller of black lies will defeat the person who's the teller of white lies. The thief will defeat the liar. The murderer will defeat the thief. The drug smuggling drug lord will defeat the murderer. And the genocidal tyrant will defeat all of them. Unfortunately, our society and our political structures tend to reward the most ruthless and vicious among us, people who will do anything to attain power, and then once they attain it, willing to do anything with it. So in these evil, dark times, the question is not what is our government capable of, what is it not capable of? Bad people rise to the top. I think the joke is, you know, that our government is like a cesspool. The really big chunks are going to float up to the top. And it really is true. And I don't think somebody should use party loyalty as an excuse to not point out that their own particular big chunk is odoriferous. So, and speaking of that, moving right along here, apparently, I don't know what it is with Dick Cheney. He's bound and determined to rub the torture scandal in everybody's face. And he's out there in Fox News, and it's going to be aired tomorrow. Former Vice President Dick Cheney has said he's okay with CIA interrogations that violated Justice Department guidelines. He's okay with torture. He's okay with war crimes. He's daring us to do something about it. And if we fail to do something about it, then history will judge us just as complicit in the crimes of the American government as present-day history judges the Germans to be complicit with the crimes of the Nazis. And I don't want to get a flood of emails saying, you can't compare the United States with the Nazis. Yeah, I can. Except the Nazis had cooler uniforms. We have got concentration camps. We have torture. We have false flag attacks involving Twin Towers to justify wars of invasion and conquest. I'm not seeing a lot of difference. I'm seeing our government and a deliberate policy of copying the methods of the Nazis, starting with Operation Mockingbird at the close of World War II. And if we just go along with it because it's our party in control, then we're no better than the Germans were. And we deserve the derision and contempt of future history. So, the problem I have with torture, outside of the fact that it's wrong, it's cruel, it's inhumane, it never gets you accurate information anyway, it gets you confessions, and that's why they're doing it, is that we, the United States, have lost our moral high ground. We are not in a position to lecture anybody else about human rights. Our government's still doing it as a prelude to war and invasion, but we've lost the moral right to lecture anybody else about human rights. Iran has just launched and funded a project to point out U.S. human rights violations. Talk about a target-rich environment. They've budgeted $20 million for it. Man, I could do it. I have done it for free here at my website. Just rock and roll. I mean, there are all plenty of opportunities there. But the real problem here with the torture relates to our ongoing wars, because now that the world knows we are torturing prisoners of war and captives, then our kids in combat face the same fate if they're captured. And maybe that's the deliberate plan to keep the war going as long as possible, because if you're following the Geneva Conventions and people who are ready to surrender to you know that they'll be treated humanely, they're more willing to surrender. But if each side knows the other is engaging in torture of prisoners, then they're going to fight to the death, and the possibilities of disarmament and peace evaporate. Maybe that was the plan. We're going to take a break for news and commercials. We'll be back in about 6 minutes. Until then, Aloha America. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
to the Michael Rivero What Really Happened radio program.
And aloha, America. Welcome to hour number two of our show here. And I just want to finish up on what we were talking about before the news break, because I got an email from somebody who said they weren't exactly sure what I was talking about. Okay. If you're in a war with somebody, isn't it really better to have the enemy surrender to you than to have to fight them? I mean, that's just common sense. The best victory is one that is bloodless, where you show up and the other army says, okay, we can't deal with this, and, you know, we quit. We quit right now. And so if both sides are following the humanitarian rules for the treatment of prisoners of war, then the person who's fighting you, opposed to you, and they're saying, well, I can go on shooting and risk dying, or I can surrender, and at least I'll get a free meal out of the deal. But if you start engaging in torture, and the other side knows that if they surrender, they're going to be tortured possibly to death, then that just keeps the fighting going. And maybe that's really the goal. For Dick Cheney to be running around screaming about, yes, it's okay for us to torture, and we're going to go on torturing, and it's necessary, and it's just. He's not trying to sell it to we, the American people. He is letting all those countries know, all those countries that the U.S. is getting ready to invade, he's letting them know that surrender is not going to get them any life or anything, that it is in their best interest to fight to the death. The goal being to grind up as many people and as much munitions on both sides in order to plunge both victor and vanquished deeper into financial debt to benefit the banks. If you've never seen the movie The International, there's this very chilling scene in there where this investigator is tracking down why this large multinational bank is buying and smuggling weapons around the world. And he's saying, well, you know, which side do they want to win? And the guy inside the bank says, it doesn't really matter, does it? The purpose of the war is to create debt. The winners go into debt. The losers go into debt. The bank doesn't matter. Debt is debt is debt. That's how the bank makes its money. By tricking countries and people deeper into debt in order to harvest the interest from them. And it seems like Dick Cheney's statements, as such as he's going to have on Fox News tomorrow, are trying to send a message to other countries that when the U.S. invades them, keep the fighting going, keep shooting, don't surrender, because you'll be tortured if you surrender. It almost seems like they're seeing this new period of warfare as a population reduction measure. Maybe that's what the world wars are supposed to be, getting rid of the useless eaters, killing off people stupid enough to put on a uniform and pick up a rifle when told to do so without a good reason. But it does seem counterproductive. It seems like Dick Cheney's goal here is not to win any of the wars he helped start, but to prolong them as long as possible, which of course benefits him financially because of his stock in Halliburton. War is a business, and the people who own the war companies, they want the war to go on forever. And maybe that's the real motive behind engaging in torture. To forestall the possibility of surrender on the other side. To keep the killing going. To keep the bloodshed going. To keep grinding up the useless eaters. To keep spending on bombs and bullets. Yesterday we were covering a story where the U.S. is buying these new bunker buster bombs that cost $5 million each. $5 million for one bomb. It is vast amounts of spending of your money, and you and your children are expected to pay and bleed for it all to make these rich people richer. Talk about being suckers. I mean, really. Now, speaking of suckers in a somewhat different context, because people in the chat room have been talking about this, as you heard on the news break, the World Health Organization has come out with dire new warnings about this new mutated form of the swine flu that goes right to the lungs, you know, just like poison gas. And they're saying, you know, there may be no other symptoms until you feel it in the lungs. And the World Health Organization came out today with a report saying the swine flu is spreading at an unbelievable rate here. Meanwhile, we're getting U.S. health officials saying exactly the opposite thing, that it is, in fact, less infectious, than ordinary seasonal flu, which we've been telling you all along. So what is going on over at the World Health Organization? Well, who is getting all the money for R&D and to run these vaccination programs? The World Health Organization. They're pumping this threat of swine flu because it is in their financial interest to do so. I mean, the World Health Organization, if it ever stood up and said, you know something, nobody around the world is all that sick, they're out of a job the next day. It's like the witch hunts in Europe. If you're going to give an organization a bunch of money to go out and find witches, they're going to find witches. Well, the World Health Organization's funding is dependent on there being a lot of sick people out there in the world. Their profitability rests on pandemics and illness. They make money off of sick people. And I think that's the reason ever since this swine flu, or we like to call it around here the when pigs fly flu, and I'll get back to that in a minute, ever since it first emerged, the World Health Organization has been at the forefront of saying, this is horrific, this is terrible, we need funding to deal with this crisis. And yet the actual reports we're getting from around the world, I mean, the rates of infection have gone into a decline. And in the same exact week, the World Health Organization said, we're not going to track individual cases anymore because the numbers were starting to go against them. So it's just amazing. Meanwhile, we're getting an interesting story here. Over in Great Britain, they spent a huge amount of money to set up these swine flu call centers, a number you could call if you were worried about the swine flu, if you thought you had it, what you should do about it. Apparently, these call centers are underutilized, to put it politely, to the point where the staffs are sitting around all day playing cards and board games like Trivial Pursuit. There are no calls coming in to these swine flu call centers. They're going to shut down two of them now. And what this tells us is the fear-mongering from World Health Organization and the vaccine manufacturers, it's not working. People are not scared. They are not being allowing, they're not allowing themselves to be driven into panic. They're keeping cool heads. Earlier this week, Fox News ran a poll, and they found out most respondents are more afraid of the vaccine than of the flu itself. So once again, we're seeing scare tactics being used to sell a product that people don't really want and can't afford anyway, and it's not working anymore. And I think this really illustrates the principle that the world is changing. The infosphere is changing because of the interactive media, the blogs, the alternative media. We're getting a diversity of opinion back out there. The population as a whole cannot be scared into going along with an agenda, whether it is paying for vaccines from campaign donors who own pharmaceutical companies, or whether it's invading another country because of stories about nuclear weapons that don't exist. It just doesn't work anymore. At some point in the very near future, corporations, advertising agencies, public relations firms, the government are finally going to move into the 21st century and realize that these old methods of pumping a product, pumping an agenda, pumping a war, pumping an economy, they don't work anymore. They can't get the traction any longer. They've either got to evolve to meet the new reality or they're going to go extinct. What do I mean by evolving to meet the new reality? Well, I'll tell you, as soon as we handle a phone call, we're going to go to Thomas in Sweden. Aloha, Thomas. Welcome to the show. What's on your mind?
I'm not going to give you a chance to tell them anything. I've got four topics here. By the way, good morning, Michael. Good morning, and aloha.
Aloha.
Let me go in on the torture business first. A week and a half ago, Swedish troops were fired on in Afghanistan, and now they're in trouble with the Defense Department here because they handed a captured soldier over to the NATO people, and they say, oh, and now they're saying from Sweden here at headquarters, oh, they might get tortured.
Mm-hmm.
All right, the Swedish thing is you never torture even normal criminals. True police killers, for example, they were put in jail here
in
Sweden.
Thomas, got to hang on for commercials. Don't go away. We're going to go right back to you after the commercial break. We'll be right back after these words from our sponsors.
Amen. America's number one source for independent talk radio for over a decade. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Some have maxed out all their credit cards. Some are working two jobs and living in cars. Minimum wage won't pay for a roof, won't pay for a drink. If you gotta have proof, distract yourself, Mr. CEO. See how far 5:15 an hour will go. Take a part-time job at one of your stores. I bet you can't make it here anymore.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the show here. And we're talking with Thomas in Sweden. And Thomas, just pick it up where you left off. Hello, it's Thomas there.
Hello, you hear me?
Yes, I hear you now. Go ahead, please.
Okay, great. This ties in with something you said a couple of days ago. You said if you had to choose between fascism and socialism, you would choose socialism. Well, over here they did even better. They have a mixed economy. It's both a lot of capitalism and a lot of socialism. But let me get back to this business of the prisoners here. The reason they objected to their own troops handing an Afghani prisoner over to NATO was that here, as there is this socialist element in the society here, it means everyone can be rehabilitated no matter what's wrong with them. I'll give you the case of two cop killers about 30 years ago. They were sent, while they were in prison, to journalist high school and to agricultural school, and today the one is a very good journalist, and the other one has his own farm about 10 minutes drive from here. And as far as the When Pigs Can Fly flu thing goes, I had that last week. That's why I didn't call in about Leonard Peltier, as I have written. And I tell you, I felt worse most March 18th.
Okay, I gotcha.
And what else can I get into here? That's about all I have. That was about three or four things all at once, but they all tie in together except for the H1N1 thing.
Yeah, the When Pigs Fly flu. All right, Thomas, we're going to let you go because we've got Solomon from Brazil is on the line, and I want to switch over to him now. Solomon, aloha. Welcome to the show. What's on your mind today?
Saravá, meu irmão Ribeiro, and good morning to your distinguished audience, and thank you, Thomas. It's always great to hear from you, and always appreciating your effort and contribution to restore truth, justice, and the philosophical American way that in my concept has to do exclusively with the concept of freedom, dear brother Ribeiro. About that, I would like to share with you and your audience my thought at this particular time. Yesterday, we kind of disagree in analyzing the conspiracy behind the crimes of our American government that really represent us all over the world. You think that it is not, that it's incompetent, and I believe the opposite.
Okay.
And in my anger with these individuals, I would like to share with you this. To me, it is necessary to get into the mind of the criminal to dissect its actions and foresee the future ones. As an example, I would like to share with you that it was reported by the media, and I think that you also mentioned that the United States is still torturing prisoners and still is doing that in third-party nations under the supervision of the CIA. Well, if I'm a responsible criminal, I'm very responsible, very intelligent criminal, very efficient, very competent criminal, why would I torture someone in a foreign country when I do really have the resources and secret prison in my own country? I would expose myself to a future blackmail by people in that country who could really video my action and request a special deal in the future, otherwise they would reveal my actions. Do we think, as an example, that Israel sends its prisoners or kidnapped people to a third country, very friendly country like Egypt or Lebanon or Jordan? I don't think so. And here's another example. Was September 11, 2001 the result of a very incompetent government or something very carefully planned?
Well, I think it was the result of at least partial incompetence because they had to bring down that one plane in Pennsylvania when I think it's pretty obvious it was intended that plane to hit World Trade Center 7. And given the fact that most Americans are now convinced the official story of 9/11 is some kind of a fraud, I think they failed. I think we have to say it was an utter failure. They got their first Afghani war out of it in the rush after the event. But, I mean, look how many years it took for half the American people to be convinced the John F. Kennedy assassination was a conspiracy. But, you know, it was like 20, 30, 40 years. Vince Foster, the cover-up on that so-called suicide, fell apart after only 3 years. The situation in Iraq, I mean, Iraq was a watershed moment because for the first time in history, the lies used to start a war became known to the general public while that war was still underway. And so, in point of fact, I think the government imagines itself to be so much smarter than the rest of the world that they're taking these incredibly dumb risks. And they've got the money and the resources to carry these operations out. But the fact that they're becoming known tells us they have failed to control public awareness of the situation. So in that regard, I have to say, yeah, I think they're actually incompetent, and I think they give themselves credit for more intelligence than they really have. And I think one of the reasons why the American people want to see an overarching conspiracy, whether you call it the Illuminati or the New World Order, is because we are raised to believe our political leaders are superior to us. They represent the best of our society. And, you know, so when we see Governor Sanford, you know, go off and catch his little honey on a ship down in South America, we're trying to figure out he's just another schmuck, you know, who's out there, you know, dipping his wick where he ought not to be doing it. And he's just another normal human being. And so when we see our politicians behaving in corrupt ways and we catch them lying and we catch them cheating and we catch them doing all this stuff, we start to say, well, there's got to be a reason beyond it because these people are too smart to be doing such dumb things. And they aren't. I mean, if Sarah Palin should have proved to us that our politicians are just ordinary people who decided to go into politics and they're not necessarily smarter than the rest of us.
Robert Rivera, I mentioned to you the first time that I called you. I'm an American citizen living in an involuntary and forceful exile, and I emphasize it. Secret prisons do exist in America. Secret halls do exist in America. And torture do exist in America. And crime does not give you a receipt. The only way to unveil the conspiracy behind this torture and all these kind of things is by popular demand. And unfortunately, our people are not demanding the truth.
Oh, yes, we are. That's why we're here. That's why we have an audience. Everybody tuned into this radio station.
But the popular demand that say, well, people, we're not going to make any step forward until we solve the problem of torture, and I want to see the faces, the names, everything, and everyone convicted and executed, then we will never progress. We will never leave this problem.
I disagree because everybody tuned into this show and everybody reading this, the website, whatreallyhappened.com, they are seekers after truth. We saw the same thing happen in the former Soviet Union when the Samizdat showed up. Once people knew it was possible to find the truth, they went out to look for it and the Soviet Union collapsed. I think we're in the middle of the same exact process here.
Well, I hope so. I want to really believe that. I still think that people emphasize more in economics and money comes and go and it's a myth. Money is just a piece of paper, but the human life is something irreplaceable, and that's the important key in this equation. The human life, torture, assassination, kidnapping, destroying countries, that is the thing that we should really be emphasizing and hammering and hammering and hammering. Everybody, not only you, not only me, not only Thomas, not only your listeners and the people who visit the website, but the whole population. But they don't do that. They are concerned with other topics. They don't want to see the past.
Okay,
and we
Solomon?
Are making the same mistake like in the past.
Solomon,
thank you,
you got it. I disagree with you, but thank you very much for the phone call and calling again. We're going to take a break. We'll be back after these words from our sponsors.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN, great talk radio starts here.
And all this with the steel was swept away.
Aloha, America. Welcome back to the show here, and we're going to get back to the phones in a minute, but I wanted to comment on a couple of things. First of all, I hear Solomon's frustration, and I understand where he's coming from. People who are just becoming, and this is not Solomon because I know he's been aware for a while, but a lot of people who are just becoming aware of all that has gone wrong with our society, and they get involved and they start they become active and they start talking to people and they do all this research, and then they say, why can't something be done? and they're waiting for something to happen. They're waiting for something to happen. And because of the inertia of entrenched privilege and wealth and 300 million Americans, affecting change takes a long time. And over time, a lot of people can get very discouraged and frustrated. And I'm hearing in Solomon, he wants to see people taking a stand against the war and torture. And we are. We're not perhaps doing it quite as fast as some individuals might like. But these things, unfortunately, sadly, do take a lot of time. I started work on my political activism. Actually, I kind of got dragged into it almost by accident 16 years ago. And 16 years ago, when I was first talking about Vince Foster and Iran-Contra and the rest of it, I never imagined that 16 years later I would still be enmeshed in all of this stuff. I really naively thought that once the public became aware of what was going on, there would be a transformation, the guilty would go to jail, and our nation would continue as it had been intended to by the founding fathers. Obviously, I know considerably better right now. Now, before we get back to the phones, I do want to get back to what I was saying just before we had the callers, and that is our institutions of media and government, public relations and so forth, advertising even, evolving to meet the new infosphere. And what I mean by that is, for the longest time, with non-interactive media, one-way media, and going all the way back to Pond's Cream, which, if you study advertising, was a revolutionary concept because they sold it with the phrase, the skin he loves to touch, and was the beginning of the so-called image sale. And because image sale is such a powerful tool, all advertising since Pond's Cream has become image sales, image selling, even political campaigns. Because it was always one way, and it worked for the majority of people, and those who were saying, look, this is all image and no substance, could not be heard. Now it is different. And for government to continue to have any legitimacy or relevance to the current American society, for advertising to have any relevance, for the corporate media to have any relevance, they have to go away from that image sale mentality. And they have to go back to making sense to the people. Because if they don't make sense, it's going to be all over the blogosphere. I think this is why Jay Rockefeller was saying he wished the Internet had never been invented. Well, too late. The genie's out of the bottle, and it is not going back. So you need to get rid of this idea of the image sale, of simply saying something looks good or it's sexy. And you need to go back and say, yes, this product has these good ingredients for you, and it doesn't have these ingredients that are bad for you. And this policy works for you because, and set out why it makes sense. Look at the healthcare proposal. It's been an image sale right from day one. And what the people in the town hall meetings are saying, read the thing and tell us what is really in there. We don't trust the packaging. We don't trust the image. We want to go back to content. What is actually in there? It's a very profound change. It's a reversal of direction for all advertising and public relations. They haven't picked up on it yet. They're still out there trying to say, well, if we use Facebook and we use MySpace and we Twitter, we can still do image selling. And it isn't working. It isn't working because the environment has changed. And you either evolve to meet a new environment or you will go extinct. And that's the bottom line. All right, we're going to go back to the phones. We've got Dennis in, Dennis from Michigan. Aloha, Dennis. Welcome to the show. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Thank you, Mr. Rivero, for your wonderful show.
Thank you for calling in. What's on your mind today?
I can't follow Solomon, but I just I was wondering if you have the wherewithal, the ability to be able to have like a decent long interview with John Perkins, who's been around the talk circuit a little bit lately.
Yes, he has, and he wrote that, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, that a lot of people, I think that was kind of a transitional work because it was part of this recognition that our financial institutions really are quite predatory in nature.
Yes.
And we always joke about things like vulture funds and whatnot, but as the economy goes down, we realize there are a lot of scavenger and vulture financing out there. In fact, just watching the TV during the commercial break, I saw another one of those commercials for the, you know, if you send us all that old beat-up gold you don't want anymore, we'll send you a bunch of these paper monetary notes. And it's like, okay, I mean, and we saw the same thing in Germany during the inflation, the hyperinflation of the Weimar Republic, where you had sharp operators were going on there saying, you know, give us your old broken gold jewelry and we'll give you baskets and baskets of this paper money. And, it was a major scam, and people didn't realize how badly they were being taken advantage of, because they were being paid pennies on the dollar for the actual worth of the gold. And the same thing is happening here. You got to be really careful.
I have an interview with him from Cindy Sheehan, which was a really a good interview from last April, and then the latest one with Jones. And
well, if you send them in, I'll post them.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
How do I do that?
Just email them to me using the email link at whatreallyhappened.com.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, because I edited them down also.
Okay. Well, Dennis, thank you very much. We're going to have to let you go because we've got other callers on the line, and I want to switch over to John in Ohio. Aloha, John. Welcome to the show. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I was listening to your top-of-the-hour comment about how just preserving the war by telling people that they can't even surrender because of the profits involved. And then I heard Solomon say that maybe these things are not as stupid as or failures as they talk about, because I was reading Professor James Petras. He turns up on globalresearch.ca often, and informationclearinghouse.info. Mm-hmm. And he was pointing out that the so-called reversion to these backward feudal elements within Iraq and these religious schisms within Iraq when prior to the United States invasion, Iraq had one of the most progressive, developed, industrialized, and intellectual countries in the entire.
They were a secular state. They were a secular state,
and that was the threat that these Mein Kampf types within the United States government, bipartisan Democrat and Republicans, saw. They could not stand to have an independent, highly developed, secularized, industrialized state in the Middle East because it interfered with their plans for world domination. And he pointed out that they systematically had assassination teams from Blackwater to the CIA to these created militia gangs that went around and actually assassinated thousands of the academics, the scientists, engineers.
I remember when that was happening. Yeah.
Prevent them from ever rising again. And John Negroponte, of course, who was the death squad master in Iran-Contra that you talked about in Honduras, was brought over there for the Salvador option of assassinating these people. And now there's 4 million that have been thrown into refugee status externally and 2 million internally. So this is an absolutely diabolical plan that had nothing to do with, you know, bringing a modernity and development either to Afghanistan or Iraq. We have always supported the most backward elements of the fundamentalist.
Because they're easiest to control.
Right, and they've destroyed that country. And I think that it's completely the reverse, as you say, of anything we've been told in the media. We're not trying to stop drug trafficking. We've been, there's 12 times more drug trafficking after we drove the Taliban.
Okay, John, we got to let you go here. We got a commercial break. Thank you very much for the phone call, and you're right about the drug trafficking. We'll be back after these words from our sponsors.
Can we talk?
Can we talk?
Can we talk about gun control?
Gun control?
Seems like it should work, doesn't it?
It should work.
You'd think so. Yeah.
Pass the right laws.
Pass the right laws.
And you can disarm the criminals.
You disarm them.
That's the idea.
But the problem is...
The problem?
Criminals don't obey the law.
They don't obey the law.
That's true.
After all, they're criminals.
They're criminals.
Criminals. They'll always find a way to get guns.
No matter how many laws you pass.
Which means
they still have guns.
They still have guns. While the rest of us...
The rest of us?
The rest of us are just left defenseless.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio? Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Welcome to the Michael Rivero What Really Happened radio program. Call Mike now at 800-259-9231. 800-259-9231.
And aloha, America. Welcome back to the last segment of our show today here. And for all of you fans of St. Al of the Gore out there, have you noticed here that in the upper northeast, where they're having, admittedly, that storm that Cindy Sheehan was telling us about here, but have you noticed the temperatures are getting down to the mid-30s? You know, in August, and yes, we're getting into September, and it's getting into autumn, but wow, it's getting really cool. In fact, just looking at the thermometer here on the island of Oahu, it's definitely trending down here. And as I said before, on a more serious note, it's going to be a rough winter. It's going to be a very difficult winter, and we've got to do something to prevent people who are in serious financial trouble from having their electricity and their gas shut off, because otherwise they're going to be dying of exposure in their own homes, or worse, they're going to be trying to warm themselves with fires in their own home, and there's going to be some accidents from there. So that is something that has to be taken care of. Other little bits of stories here. They finally got one of the big computer hackers. He admits he's guilty. He gets between 15 and 25 years in prison. Yes, 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 yes. And as you may have surmised by now, we have suffered mightily at the hands of hackers. Ours are more politically motivated than financially. But still in all, it's good to see it finally starting to happen out there, because, you know, I mean, the U.S. government, their whole law enforcement and anti-terror credibility is absolutely destroyed by the fact that they can't find the people sending us Viagra ads every single day. Now, turning over to Israel, Israel continues to be a major headache for everybody. There's an article in the Los Angeles Times. The headline is, Israel has Iran in its sights. And the copy reads, Iran has until late September to respond to the latest international proposal aimed at stopping the Islamic Republic from developing a nuclear weapon. But if diplomacy fails, the world should be prepared for an Israeli attack on Iran's suspected nuclear weapons facilities. Okay, folks, little bit of a history lesson here. When Israel went in and bombed Iraq's nuclear power station at Osirik, Israel was making the same excuse. It's a suspected nuclear weapons facility. Following the 2003 invasion, a group of international inspectors, including the International Atomic Energy Agency, the United Nations' own nuclear watchdog, they went into the ruins of the Osirik power station, and they found a power station. They did not find any evidence at all to back up Israel's accusations that Iraq had been building nuclear weapons underneath the Osirik reactor. We know Israel is doing that under Dimona because of the photos leaked out by Mordecai Vanunu. So maybe Israel's just projecting their own guilt on other countries. It's okay for us to be building secret nuclear weapons because they're all doing it. You know, it's like when you have a married couple and one of them is having an affair, they're catching a little on the side, and they assuage their guilt by accusing their partner of being the one who's stepping out. Maybe that's what Israel's doing. But they're definitely doing it. The bottom line, though, is Israel committed an act of war against Iraq by bombing their civilian power station under the excuse that they knew it was a clandestine nuclear weapons laboratory. And they were wrong. They were wrong. They were wrong. They were wrong. So Israel is batting zero in terms of knowing who is and who is not building nuclear weapons underneath their power station. So why should we be allowing Israel to go ahead and commit another act of war against another foreign country when we know they have such a lousy record for picking their targets? Now, the bottom line is, everyone's talking about stopping the Islamic Republic from developing a nuclear weapon. Nobody has found any evidence that they have started. Iran is building a nuclear power station, which they have the legal right to do under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. which Iran has signed. And so has the United States, which means under treaty obligation, the highest law of the land, superseding even the Constitution, the United States recognizes Iran's right to build a nuclear power station. Moreover, under Article 4 of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the United States is obligated to help Iran build it. If the real concern was the possibility of a clandestine nuclear weapons laboratory underneath the power station, the best way to make sure it's not there is for the United States to be in Iran, helping to pour the concrete foundations, lay the pipes, and solder the wiring together. And then we would know for a fact that there is no nuclear weapons laboratory underneath the power station. But the U.S. isn't taking this very simple and mandatory requirement under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Because the goal here is not to prevent Iran from obtaining nuclear weapons, but to simply justify another war of conquest. They lied to us about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. Why should we assume they're being truthful about Iran? Both the United States and Israel have a track record of lying to justify attacking their enemies. Of course they're lying now. I mean, if Iran wanted to build a nuclear weapon, and I would certainly understand it if they did, because Iraq was an object lesson to the world of what the United States will do to countries that don't have nuclear weapons, the U.S. will invade and take over. Same thing with Afghanistan. Same thing with Somalia. The U.S. goes in, invades, and takes over. Because these countries cannot fight back. They lack the weapons to do it. So Iran would be justified in seeking a nuclear weapon. So far, nobody's found any evidence that they actually are. And even if they did, let us, for the point of argument, say that Iran has built a nuclear bomb. Ooh, look at the big nuclear bomb. Got a radiation symbol on the side and everything. What are they going to do with it? What is Iran going to do with that weapon? They might put it in a museum. They might put it on a trailer and march it down Tehran in the middle of a military parade and say, ooh, we're butch. They're not going to use it against the United States of America. Iran is not a threat to the United States of America, even with a nuclear weapon. Because the United States still possesses the world's largest, most powerful nuclear arsenal. We have thousands of nuclear weapons. Our government is building a brand new generation of tactical nuclear weapons. We have them in missiles in submarines. We have them in missiles in silos. We have them in cruise missiles. We have them in aerial bombs. We have stealth bombers. We have submarines. We have a nuclear arsenal sufficient to destroy any other nation on Earth. A single Ohio-class ballistic missile submarine can lay waste to all of Iran's major cities. Just one submarine. Iran is not going to attack us. They just aren't. They're not a threat. And the reason is very, very simple. My parents' generation footed the tax bill for $5 trillion, back when $1 trillion was really a lot of money. Not like today, where a trillion here and a trillion there, and it's just pocket change in our inflated economy. But in my parents' generation, where $1 trillion was an unimaginable amount of money, they paid, we're still paying, to develop this monstrous nuclear nightmare to unleash on our enemies as a deterrent. And they use the word deterrent even though the United States is and remains the only nation to actually employ nuclear weapons against the civilians of another country. But we were sold the idea that it was okay to build all of these thousands and thousands of nuclear weapons and the means to deliver them anywhere in the world, because it would prevent other nations from attacking us. Okay, well, you can't have it both ways. If this deterrent works and other nations are too scared to attack us, then Iran can have all the nuclear weapons it wants, and it's still not a danger to the United States. If, on the other hand, Iran with a single nuclear weapon is cause for all America to tremble, then that huge nuclear deterrent that we have built and maintained at hideous expense, the submarines, the missiles, the stealth bombers, the rockets, all of it, was a complete waste of money. Let's scrap it and cut our losses. You don't get it both ways. Meanwhile, final thought, Desmond Tutu was interviewed in Haaretz, and he's saying Arabs are being made to pay the price of the Holocaust, which is absolutely true, especially when you consider that the Arabs had nothing to do with the Holocaust. Whatever you think the Holocaust was, the Arabs had nothing to do with it. Why are they being made to pay for it? That's it for our show. We'll be back Monday here on the Genesis Communication Network, 5 p.m. Central Time. Thanks to all the callers. Thanks especially to Cindy Sheehan. What a courageous, courageous woman. She deserves a Nobel Peace Prize. Jimmy Carter, if you're listening to the show, nominate her for me, please. Thank you very much. Until Monday, aloha, America.